House Committee on Business and Labor for May 8th, 2013. We're going to start, I think, since we have at least Representative Buckley here. Are you speaking on 836, sir? Okay, so we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 836. Jan, if you could summarize, please.
Hello, Madam Chair, committee members. This measure modifies the exemptions to regulated cosmetology disciplines, declares emergency effective on passage, no amendment, came over from the Senate on a vote of 27-0, no revenue, no fiscal impacts.
Representative Buckley?
We get the co-chair for this?
Wow.
Of course.
Have to give him a bad time.
Oh, sorry. No. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County and legislature. I also, you might recall, Madam Chair, I represent the Oregon Shakespeare Festival from my district, and I'm here on behalf of the Shakespeare Festival and other theatrical organizations, operatic organizations as well. The bill clarifies the fact that artists in the field of theater, dance, opera can do makeup, can do hair without being licensed. The question came up whether there was a license requirement for it. This bill clarifies that no, someone who works in the costume shop, who also does wigs, who also does makeup, would be able to continue to do that work as they currently perform it for the various arts organizations around our state, including the film and video as well. And I am grateful for the senator for bringing this forward.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18, which is includes Representative Doherty's district of Tigard and parts of Southwest Portland. I really appreciate you taking up this bill. It's a great bill to keep Oregon competitive in the film and video industry and to support our state treasure, the Shakespeare Festival that my colleague here just testified on. These are very specialized individuals who are covered by this bill. Just to make sure that they are on the right track, I myself got made up by one of them recently, and it was amazing what they could do. I think I'm going to hire one full time.
You're going into movies?
And while I was being made up in a pretty conventional way, I also observed them making people up in a more Grimm-like way, if you get my drift from the series Grimm. They really perform magic. There is no need for them to be put through these hoops that have nothing to do with their areas of specialty. They make the magic in the film and video and in the plays, and I really appreciate the committee taking up this issue so they can continue to do so in Oregon. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Morning.
Senator Williamson, we've got the
Chair Doherty.
We have the triumph rate here.
Yes. Sorry, I was a little late. I don't want to repeat anything that the senator said, but I didn't hear it all. So I will just tell a story.
Yes. And if you want to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, thank you. Jennifer Williamson. I represent House District 36, which is downtown northwest and southwest Portland. Last week during Industry Day, there was a woman who made somebody up as a Sasquatch. I don't know if you saw her. And she asked me about this bill and said, you know, if we don't pass this bill, she would have to go to beauty school. She said, for me, that's 4 months off of working. I'm the primary breadwinner in my family. Mm-hmm. And I don't need to learn how to wax hair off of people. I put hair on people. And so she was very concerned about the economic impact on her family if she had to go and get a license that, in her view, didn't add to her craft at all. In fact, it would just take her out of circulation for several months and cost a lot of money. So that's the issue we're trying to get at with this bill. So thank you for hearing it.
Okay. And I would assume, I don't know if you'll know it or the next speakers that are coming up, but the people that are, especially the makeup artists and the wig artists and so on, I assume that they have training through other institutions other than what we would consider our cosmetology area.
Madam Chair, correct. Many of them actually learn their trade through an apprenticeship with a theater company or a film and video production company, and of course our theater arts programs in all our universities do teach makeup and hair as part of their programs.
Okay.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Fagan.
And I would also probably just add as a comment, but they're not working on the public, so for them to get a job doing this, they're going through kind of a competitive hiring process. I mean, I certainly don't make it a routine to try and put hair on my face as a member of the public, as a consumer. So, yeah, they're also not working with members of the public, which is kind of, you know, the idea of the other folks who are being licensed in this are working regularly with the public.
Right. Any other questions? Representative Matthews.
I just want to be clear. So, Representative Williamson, so this would allow me, without a license, to perhaps make up somebody like Chaka from the Land of the Lost. Is that correct?
Yes. If you're not a member of the public and you were working, you know, on a film and video set, theater, sure.
Thank you for that.
Sure. With all due respect, I think there would be some competitive issues if you didn't get an apprenticeship first.
Yes, they are union, by the way.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would assume that these makeup artists are not being paid directly by the particular actors or people that are receiving the makeup. They're being paid by a company.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvet, that's correct. In the bad old days, actors used to have to pay people directly out of the meager salaries they were paid. But with the Actors Equity Union and other positive steps towards with performers in the United States, that is no longer a practice, and makeup artists, hair artists are paid for by the production company.
And follow-up, I would assume the Board of Cosmetology does not have a problem with this bill either.
Not that we're aware of it. It passed unanimously in the Senate.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Thatcher?
Mostly a comment. First, if I had my camera, I'd snap a picture and say, these people were asking for less regulation today. Cool. And I think that we need to look at licensing laws all across the board, because I think they can serve as false barriers to entry and protectionism for certain, you know, whatever groups. And I think that you're on to something here, and I appreciate it. Bringing it forward.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Representative Thatcher. We'll get together because I have an idea.
Yeah.
All right.
So, okay. Any other questions of the panel? Okay, thank you very much
thank
for
you,
testifying.
Thank you, members.
We have about five others that want to testify, and I'm going to have to kind of tighten up the time. So how about Vince Porter, Christina Cortum, and Eva Lose? And then after that, we've got Selena Rubin and Charles Carlson.
Short and sweet, because
yes.
Probably all of us are supporting this, aren't we?
Yeah. We're pretty supportive, so.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Yes.
I will be very short and sweet. My name is Vince Porter. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Film and Video Office. For us, the reason why I'm here to testify in favor of the bill is it's mostly a recruitment issue and an economic issue in that Grimm is one obvious example. This issue did not come up to us, actually, until this year. Previously, there had never been any kind of a conversation about, and we were caught by surprise that, in fact, this was a regulation in the state of Oregon. It's not one in any other state that we know of, and as has been discussed, there are certain very specialties on projects like Grimm. Also, when you bring in certain talent, they have contracts that they are they have the right to pick what kind of makeup artists they want on them. And if we, as a state, tell them that they can't abide by those contracts, it would be a serious problem. So I'm here in favor of the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name's Christina Cordham, and I was the creator of the Sasquatch. And it's true. This would have a severe economic impact on many hardworking film and TV makeup artists in the state. It is, to go to school for something I will never use is pretty hard to swallow and take. And it's, makeup in TV and film is so different. I have gone through a lot of training. I have taken classes. I am, you know, have done, spent so much time and effort and money to get as highly trained as I am, and to be shut down because I don't have an aesthetics license. And I really don't want to wax people. I do want to put hair on people. Also, just so you know that all the makeup artists on Grimm, there's not a single one with an aesthetics license. It's because it's so unrelated. Mm-hmm. Makeup schools, the top makeup schools in the country, do not offer aesthetics license, like the film and TV makeup schools mm-hmm. I'm talking about in L.A. and the big ones that people pay thousands and thousands of dollars to go through, do not give you an aesthetics license at the end because it's so unrelated. Mm-hmm. It does not have any bearing on what we do. Everything we do is temporary. We want it to come off at the end of the day. We want to make sure the actor looks exactly the same when they leave because they're going to have to go to another production. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for the information.
Hi, good morning. My name is Eva Loza. I was department head on Leverage for, gosh, a season and a half. I was on the show for 3 years. I'm a recent transplant to Oregon from Los Angeles. I've been a practicing makeup artist for 16 years. And if I had known that this was going to be sort of an issue, it seems sort of silly, simply because what we do working in film, television, and theater is for entertainment. And in the legislation, the way that it is now, it says something for the beautification of the skin. What we do has nothing to do with skin health. It has nothing to do with changing someone's appearance semi-permanently. It has everything to do with collaborating with a director, with a costume designer, with any number of other people to create a character. And it has nothing to do with making someone look beautiful. If creating that character happens to make a pretty girl look prettier, then that is the character that the director has chosen. And I just wanted to say that those are two very different things. If you want to be an esthetician, you go over here. If you want to be a makeup artist, you go over here. And sort of never the twain shall meet. So to have to backtrack and go in the opposite direction in order to continue my craft in the state would be counterproductive entirely. Okay. Thank you very much.
Any questions of the panelists? And thank you so much for the clarification on on Grimm, you do, no offense, but you don't make people prettier. I guess that's a compliment.
Thank you.
Pretty is in the eye of the beholder,
perhaps. That's true.
Just mentioning, Madam Chair, they can also add cornrows and hair extensions after this,
yes,
too.
Yes, you can.
Hey, that takes a limited license, though.
That's right. Okay, the next people we have, Selena Rubin and Charles Carlson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Carlson. I'm the Oregon representative of the IETSE, Local 488, Stone Film and Video Technicians. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 836, and I need to clarify previous testimony on the House side that I thought the statutes changed in 2012. Actually, they changed in 1993, and we weren't aware of it, but I need to make that correction. So. On that, everything I wanted to say has already been said. I've presented written testimony, so I'm not going to belabor on that. I think mainly that it's not compensated by the people that receive the services, and it's temporary. The Sasquatch that was created here, that was done illegally because she was compensated slightly for that. After the rally, I met with Senator Boquist. His daughter does special effects makeup for defense films. They do reenactments of scenes for studying for defense. And she can't work in Oregon under this current statutes because she doesn't have an assistant license. So I'm here and I'm favor of support, and I ask you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty. It's nice to see you again. I met you at the rally and members of the committee. Thank you so much for being interested in this bill. My name is Selena Rubin. I'm the reason why we're all here today. The reason why I brought this to Senator Burdick's attention is because, well, to start from the beginning, I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a professional makeup artist, and I moved here almost 2 years ago from Los Angeles, where I worked for many years as a makeup artist. And I decided I wanted a better quality of life, so I moved to Oregon. And I chose Oregon because of the booming film industry and the commercial and advertising industry, because I knew I could make and continue to make a living as a makeup artist. But recently I was informed by OHLA that I had to stop working as a makeup artist. I could not work anymore. And I had to in fact, remove any evidence on my website or and stop promoting myself as a working makeup artist in Oregon. Well, that induced panic, and I immediately notified Senator Burdick about this this law that didn't make any sense because, as they said before, aesthetics doesn't have any relation to makeup artistry, and I need to support my family, and I need to work, and I need to get back to work immediately. So that's what's happening here. And all of us makeup artists that contribute to all of the amazing shows and movies and commercial advertising, because there's a lot of commercial advertising that brings millions of dollars of revenue to the state, should also be included as the importance of what makeup artistry brings to the state. We all need to get back to work, and we need this bill passed. And thank you so much for your support for Senate Bill 836.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Kennedy.
Just a comment. Ms. Rubin just mentioned that the bill has an emergency clause, which is appropriate. So
yeah, and, then, and that just means that, as soon as the governor signs it, it is law.
And I can start working again.
That's the hope.
Yeah. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you being here. And for the booming film industry, the commercial advertising, and the undiscovered talent that's in the state, right?
Yes.
Anyway, but thanks for clarifying that this actually started in 1993, because I had nothing to do with that. So glad to make the vote today to hopefully change this and get this back on track. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Any other questions? Okay, I do have one question, and maybe it just shows the increase. Has there been an increase in IOTC members since we've started this? Because you were talking about that you basically kind of represent all the technicians and so on.
We've gone from 325 to 550 just since the advent of the Leverage and the Grimm Productions.
Okay, big boom. Thank you very much. Okay, anybody have anything else?
And that's just members. We have another 3,000 people that work through us that do it temporarily, not full-time.
Okay. Excellent. It's nice to hear. Okay, any other questions? Thank you all so much for coming here today. Those are the only people we have signed up. Anybody else want to speak on Senate Bill 836? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 836 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 836.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 836 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 836 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Let's do it. Good bill.
Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll?
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Holdy.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Wagner.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Penneman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative
Martin.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. And I think we'll have Representative Williamson carry to the floor. Okay, with that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 836. Thank you very much. And open a work session on public hearing on Senate Bill 252A.
Madam Chair, committee members, this measure increases the minimum penalty to employers for a continued late filing of their unemployment insurance quarterly report to $200 from the current penalty of $85.25, which is based on a formula. It increases the penalty for a continued late filing of a zero payroll quarterly report from $5 to $25. Takes effect 91st day after signing die. No amendments came over from the Senate on a vote of 16 to 12. There's a revenue statement issued as well as a fiscal statement issued.
Okay, we have one person signed up, David Gisfield from the Employment Department.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department, here testifying in favor of Senate Bill 252. This deals with the quarterly payroll reports that employers file with us. Each quarter, they are required to file reports that tell us who, if anyone, was working for them and the amount of wages that they paid. We use that to make sure that all employers are paying the payroll taxes that they're required to, and importantly, it's also essential in how we administer the benefits part of the unemployment insurance system. So when someone first files a claim for benefits, one of the first steps is looking at their earnings history to see if they're eligible for benefits. So we rely on these reports to have that information. If an employer doesn't file those reports, we don't know when someone files a claim whether they're eligible for benefits, so it can delay us getting benefits to people that are entitled to them. It can also result in us having incomplete information, so we pay person on one type of claim when they should actually be receiving another, so that can result in some benefit payment overpayments, which we want to minimize. So it is important for us to have this information. We've tried to make the filing, especially of the reports when employers are saying that they've had no employees in a particular quarter, as easy as possible. They can do that by filling out the paper report. There's an online way to fill that out. They can also actually call up over the phone and enter their PIN and employer ID number and tell us that they had no employees, and that constitutes a filing. So we've tried to make that easy. We still do have employers that don't file. The statutes currently address this. It says that if an employer doesn't file, they get a written warning the first time. And if they're late again within 3 years of the written warning, then they receive a penalty. But this bill retains that overall structure. It just changes the minimum penalty. There are two different minimum penalties that come into play. For the employers that are late and they did actually have employees, there's a statutory formula. And for the minimum penalty right now, that works out to $85.25. This bill would raise that minimum to a flat $100, so approximately $15 increase from what it currently is. For employers that are telling us that they had no employees, the current statutory penalty is $5. That is significantly less than it costs us to issue the assessment. We generally don't issue invoices to anyone if the amount that we're billing for is less than $10, because we have limited resources. So we have real difficulties using this as a tool to encourage employers to file the reports. So this minimum penalty of $5 would be increased under the bill to $25. The original bill had that going to $100, and through some discussions in the Senate committee, there was a consensus reached, and that was changed to $25, trying to weigh how big of a burden it would be on businesses while making sure that we had the information we need to efficiently and timely administer the program. So we are asking for support for Senate Bill 252. This is one of a number of bills that the department is pursuing that addresses the overall integrity of the unemployment insurance program. This focuses on one narrow aspect. We have some other bills that are going forward. I did want to mention that on the Senate side, when this went forward in the original version, we did have the support of Associated Oregon Industries, even when it was at the $100 level, not because they are necessarily in favor of increasing penalties, but they saw this as part of a good faith effort, and I believe this was their testimony, to address overpayment issues that may have causes with employers and with claimants, and looking at the broader package of bills. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Widener?
How did you end up with a 500% increase in your penalty? I mean, I could see maybe doubling it, but, I mean, you got a 5 multiplier on this, which is extremely high. I mean, I wish I could make that kind of margin in my business.
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, it is a 500% increase, but it's from $5 to $25. So we thought that doing, a 10% increase, we'd still be in the single digits for how many dollars. When we looked at this, we tried to get something that was not too onerous on employers. We don't think that $25 is too onerous. We're still keeping the written warning the first time. We're also looking at something that we thought would encourage compliance. Right now, over half of the people that we assess this penalty against have previously received both the written warning and the penalty. So we feel like the existing penalties just aren't sufficient. We thought that $25, we feel that strikes an appropriate balance.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
Wouldn't it seem more appropriate to kind of have it step so we hit them with $5 and if they fall out of compliance again, it goes to 10 and stair steps up that way to drive the message home rather than just bump it completely up because somebody may have messed up once?
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, it does step up in that you get the written warning the first time, so there's no penalty. You certainly could approach it by having a stair step. The one other provision that's in the existing statute that I didn't mention and should have that we're not proposing to change is that if the employer does have good cause for being late with their filing, the penalty doesn't get assessed. And that's whether it's the first, second, third, or fourth time that they're late. So if we give them the written warning, and then they're late again, but it was through, you know, they put it in the mail, it didn't get to us, unexpected blackout as they were trying to file on the internet or something like that, then we would not assess the penalty.
Okay. Any other questions? I do have one question. When was the last time the penalty was raised? Do you know?
Chair Doherty, I don't have that offhand. I can certainly follow up and get that. I don't know that it has ever been raised, at least the $5 penalty. My belief is that that's the original penalty amount that was in the statute.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
That's fine. I'll take it off
more. Do we have anybody else? This is the only person we have signed up for Senate Bill 252.
Jan.
Anyone? Jan? We have Jan.
Thank you, Chairwoman Doherty, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Business, truly representing small business. Most of our employers have less than 10 employees. We do have some that have, a few hundred, but those are few. Regarding 252, initially we were opposed to the bill that, as I recollect, the $25 per filing, particularly for those that have zero payroll to report, that was onerous. And you get these small employers that really don't understand if they have no employees that they need to report. So that's a burden. And obviously, in this economic environment, they have so many fees and penalties that they have to deal with across the broad spectrum that we never like to have additional fees and penalties. But we also understand that without timely reporting unemployment benefits are paid that should not be paid because they didn't have the information, when that approaches millions of dollars in that respect from inadequate data, that it has an effect of increasing the unemployment insurance rates on all employers. So we certainly are sensitive that those bad actors again, that there should be a situation where they are compelled to comply to give the state the information that it needs to make proper unemployment benefits. We don't support this, but we're not supportive, we're not a yes vote, we're not enthusiastic about the bill, but we're also not going to, we're not opposing it because we see that it is a necessary situation, and that with the Dash A from $25 per filing to $25, that makes it so it's not quite so onerous for those with zero employment.
Okay,
to report.
Any questions, Ms. Meekum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony.
Yes.
Clarifying that. I guess I'd say, thanks for the work on this on the Senate side. I still am a little concerned, though, and would like to know your thoughts on if this were a tiered system so that truly those that might be avoiding the responsibility or, the bad actors, if we will. I always feel like I'm offending Gilliam. But I just wonder if
he's on a roll today.
If a tiered system, such as what Representative Widener suggested earlier, if that would have been something that maybe you would have entertained a little more.
Absolutely. We would. That would be preference. That would be preferable.
Yeah. Thank you.
As to give them more opportunity to get themselves compliant and...
Yeah. And Madam Chair, if I will, my thoughts on that are, of course, your goal is to gain compliance. And when I looked at the revenue and the fiscal statements, both, it looks like, it's going to cost a little to make the first years, and then it's going to cost less for the state. And, of course, they'll gain a little bit less because we're assuming compliance happens. But I certainly think that if we had a way to get to the new business or the educational piece, without the increase yet. I know it's only $25, but it is $25 to the business.
Especially for a startup that's just trying to learn the ropes and figure out how all of this works.
Yeah, I wish we could have found a tiered system here, and I just wonder why that didn't happen, but thank
you. That would absolutely be preferable for us. And the one thing, when it was stated that there are 4,800 employers, that's a lot on one hand, but if you look at it in the scheme of how many employers there are in the state, I think there's like 132,000 small business employers. It's really not a large amount, but it's, on one hand, it's significant as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to comment real quickly on Matthews, Representative Matthews. It's just that, like in anything, with a tiered system, hopefully it would be tiered enough that it doesn't cost the state of Oregon money to have to go through and get the fee. And $5 is, or even $10. But because sometimes we go through and say, well, let's keep the fees low. But yeah, on the other hand, it costs more for the state to go through and process that. So.
And Madam Chair, just to clarify, and I guess I'll put myself out there, I'm not necessarily saying that the tier stops at a 25 level. What I'm saying is that we might go from 5 to 10 to get the compliance, but if you're one of those habitual offenders, it might go beyond the 25, would be my thoughts. But again, that's not my desire to raise it on small business, but it is my desire to gain compliance where necessary.
Exactly. Other comments?
Yeah.
Representative Kenner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, in light of Representative Widener and Representative Matthews' comments, I wonder if it would be appropriate to see if maybe some of the parties could have a little discussion about creating a tier. At least I would find that more attractive.
Okay. Is that acceptable? I see nods in the back, so that would be it. Representative Colby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, not that I would be opposed to the tier system, but as I listen to the testimony, at some point, where we'd be asking the employment department to be sending and processing these complaints at a loss to the fund, where it actually costs them more money to process it than the $5 penalty. And so where do you get the compliance? Because they would just, from what I understand, they would just not even process that penalty and have less compliance, which then impacts the fund. So at some point there's a
there's a
balance. We ask government to operate efficiently, like a business would. No business would sell a product at a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And so at some point there's a bottom line here where it's processing this penalty costs some money, and so we have to recover that cost. So I just want to make that point.
Chair Doherty, for the record, David Gerstenfeld of the Employment Department. Just wanted for the record to say that we're certainly willing to talk about looking at establishing a tiered system of approaching this, but we would want to, as Representative Polvey and others have pointed out, we would want to make sure that it's a tiered system that would get us to compliance without forcing us to stop doing other activities that we do because of the cost. But we're certainly willing to have that discussion.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Representative Widener?
Since David came back up. Question is to you, there's a lot of people who file these private corporation or different filings for reasons unknown. They'll start a business. Could be because they're Amway members or something like that. How often do these people get caught up in this? So individuals that just start a business, it's a husband, wife, out of their house, they don't have any employees or anything, and then we start hitting them with questions like this. Do they get a boxing check as I have no employees and they're not going to get bothered anymore?
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, the reports are only filed, this particular report, for businesses that have employees. So if they have no employees, they don't have to file that report. If they once get employees, so they're required to file, and maybe things are slowing down or they know they're not going to have employees for a period of time, they can notify us, and we tell them that's fine. When you have employees again, you need to resume filing. So yes, there is an opportunity for them to not have to file when they don't have employees.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify on Senate Bill 252? I see none. I close the public. Excuse me.
Just a comment. So we're going to expect them to
yes.
have a discussion and come back to us.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I close public hearing on Senate Bill 252 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 294. Mr. Campbell?
Madam Chair, committee members, this measure permits taxi cab drivers to use mobile communication devices for voice communication while driving. No amendment came over from the Senate on a vote of 19-11. No revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Darren Campbell, and I represent Radio Cab in Portland, Oregon. Not only am I the lobbyist for Radio Cab, but I'm also an owner-operator at Radio Cab, and that's where I make most of my living when I'm not here at the Capitol. Radio Cab is the largest cab company in the state of Oregon with a fleet of over 220 cabs. We have over 550 independent contractor drivers. During the 2011 legislative session, House Bill 3186 was passed in an attempt to close loopholes the 2009 legislation allowed. The intent of the legislature was that cab drivers qualified under the cell phone exemption. However, when the law was refined, our industry was left out of that. I can attest that when I work as a cab driver, my car is my office. My cell phone is an intricate part of my ability to earn a living. In preparation for this hearing, I looked back at the last 5 years of accidents involving radio cabs, and I could not find a single one that indicated that cell phone use was at fault for the accident. I believe that this is a simple housekeeping bill and would encourage you sending it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, do you have any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Campbell, thank you for coming in. And I voted against the bill in 2009, the original bill. I have since concluded that I was wrong on that one. I think it's, on the whole, good law, good public policy. But I don't understand, I guess, the purpose of this bill. We have this law in place for safety purposes. I think it's a demonstrable fact that talking on a cell phone while driving is less safe. It seems to me that the underlying safety standards for a taxi cab that's actually carrying passengers should be greater, not less, than it is for private citizens. But can you? Why should taxi cab drivers be exempt?
Madam Chair, Representative Barton, our company has a hardline stance that, you know, we encourage Bluetooth whenever possible. However, just like all technology, it fails from time to time. We want to see the people that drive for Radio Cab and other taxi companies around the state to succeed as best they can. And I know from experience that anytime I get a parking ticket, a speeding ticket or whatever, you know, it might take me a day or two or three days to make up that amount of money that I'm losing. The percentage of what we're looking at here is very slim. It would be under very particular circumstances that one of our drivers would fall into this, but it does happen. And we're just trying to look out for our people and make sure that they have every opportunity to succeed.
Can I follow up, please? Mm-hmm. So, and I don't mean to be giving you a hard time.
No,
but I mean,
he's a lawyer.
I don't feel that the question was answered. This law right now, that they can still talk on the phone to their heart's content, just like any of us can, provided it's using a hands-free device. This law would exempt that. This would now be legal to talk on the cell phone while driving with five babies in the back if they want. That's the legislative change you are affirmatively asking us to make, and I have yet to hear any articulation as to why this is better public policy for Oregon, except for the fact that it would be mildly preferable for your members. I mean, I respect that, but that's not quite getting there for me.
Well, you know, and maybe I don't have the clearest answer for you, Representative Barton, but, you know, being that there might be five babies in my back seat, right, I'm not going to use the cell phone. I'm going to make sure that I am responsible, I pull over, and I do the right thing. This is geared more towards if we have that equipment failure with a Bluetooth or whatnot. It's more to be able to find our fares or find out where we need to go or find out information for our fares. There is a lot of self-responsibility that we need to take on as cab drivers, and we promote that through our company. And like I said before, it's a very slim margin of of where cab drivers might fall under the penalty.
May I follow up one more time?
Mm-hmm.
I hear what you're saying, and I believe that you and the vast majority of members are responsible and would do that. However, unless I'm misreading the bill, that's not what this bill does. This bill would fully allow you to chat using your hands on the cell phone with five babies in the back. If we wanted to narrow it for that unusual exception, such as when there's an underlying equipment failure, or you know, if we need to tailor to that extraordinary circumstance, we should do that. But right now, I don't, unless I'm misreading the bill, I don't think it does that.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Other comments? Representative Kinnamer?
I guess I'm wondering about this, too. I think we want to be careful about granting the exceptions. On the other hand, most of the time, you're in fairly heavy traffic, and trying to pull off to make a phone call would probably be as difficult as, or worse, more threatening. I wonder about that. You know, and I guess most of these phone calls are either about future rides or trying to find a destination that you're not aware of. I don't know exactly why you use a cell phone. Hopefully, it's not to chat with your neighbors or your girlfriend.
Correct.
When you're driving.
You know, there's a million different circumstances that I could cite as to why trying to pull over in traffic might be more dangerous, or simply using a cell phone might be more dangerous. It's all circumstantial. I think you could go either way on that. But the majority of cell phone use for us as taxi drivers is business related. This is our office. It's much like the exemption for the tow truck drivers or the city worker. It's their office as well, and it's an intricate part of us doing our job.
Okay, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I respect where you're trying to go. I just honestly think that every profession out there could make a case and make some sort of compelling argument why they should be excluded. I think a realtor could do that. I think pizza delivery could do that. I think we could do that as legislators. We're in our mobile office. I'm on the road, 2.5 to 3 hours a day commuting, and we're not excluded. The exemptions were specifically towards public safety, and we made the first mistake in 2009 and then corrected that to narrow that scope. But I think it would be helpful if you could at least explain how you're dispatched and the equipment that's already in your vehicle, because these aren't just cars that you just jump in and if something happened to your car, you can go get another car tomorrow. They're equipped for dispatch. So why don't you tell us how that works, if you could, just briefly.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Representative Matthews, I appreciate you bringing that point up, because the cell phone is probably one of the least of our distractions. We have a computer system that is a dispatch system that is fairly intricate in putting yourself into the system, and you get dispatch calls through that. We also have a two-way radio that we can communicate with our dispatch center with, as well as GPSs and pretty much every other distraction you can think of. So the cell phone distraction is actually rather minimal compared to the other things that we have. And if I may, to your point in regards to exemption for legislators or for any other industry, there are very few industries where you are in the vehicle for 12 to 14 hours per day, and that's 100% of your job. I would find it hard for a tow truck driver even to say that they're in their car 12 or 14 hours a day and they're exempt. And that would be my argument, is that a realtor has, they're going house to house and they're in homes showing homes, and they're not in their car more than going from one place to the next, and then they're out doing their job. Our job is specifically in a vehicle.
Madam Chair, my point was a lobbyist representing their interests would make a very compelling argument. Obviously, you're not their lobbyist. You're there for Radio Cab and for your industry. But thank you for bringing it up. My goal wasn't to create yet another distraction in the car, but it was to say that your compelling argument is you need to have contact with your fares to find out where they're at and where they're located. You have several tools already in the vehicle that tell you that, and you have a GPS system as well. So you have a lot of communication points already without being on the phone. With respect to the comment that the good representative made about five babies in the car, I would imagine I would pass on that fare. I wouldn't take five babies in my car.
Unfortunately, the city of Portland tells us that we have to take that.
But I do want to be clear. I respect your profession. I respect, you know, that you all have the integrity. I don't think that everybody's looking for a way out of the law, but I have a hard time getting there for you. I really do. I just seeing the need.
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, we do have a lot of communication points and information references, but the one that we're lacking is the one that gives us direct communication with our customers. And if you look at 3rd and Davis in downtown Portland on a Saturday night, you have 8,000 people running around there. Trying to find your one passenger can be a very difficult challenge at times. And there's a lot of addresses and new areas of the Portland metropolitan area, new developments that aren't on GPS. They're not even on our dispatch radar yet. Finding those locations require us to get a hold of our customer.
But the point is, you have the ability to use a phone now. You just have to have either a wired-in headset or a Bluetooth, and you can use your phone.
Exactly. And we do promote that as much as possible. Okay.
Representative Fagan, then Representative Kennemer.
Yeah, like my colleagues, I certainly appreciate you coming and advocating on behalf of your members. I'm not going to be able to be supportive, and I'm going to tell you why. I don't have five babies, but I have one, and my husband and I frequently use cabs whenever we go to the airport, and as is true of just regular drivers as well, people still do use their cell phones while they're driving, and it was only in the past, probably, it was literally the day after the election, so it was November 7th, we were going to the airport, and we had our two-month-old baby strapped in the back, and our cab driver started using the cell phone while we were driving, which, you know, as a new mom with a new baby, and I'm incredibly hardcore about not using my cell phone while driving. I actually keep it usually in my trunk in the purse, in my purse in the trunk, and this person was talking, clearly doing business, and you know, my husband and I, being new protective parents, actually tapped the guy on the shoulder and said, will you please hang up your phone, because it made us incredibly uncomfortable, the fact that somebody was driving us and our new two-month-old around to the airport on the freeway going 70 miles an hour, and even though it was for his business, was talking on his cell phone. So I agree with Representative Barton, you know, that while I certainly recognize it's a headache for your members, but to me it is a serious public safety issue, and you know, you do have the ability to use Bluetooth. Like you said, it's the narrow circumstance in which there's a, you know, device failure. In that case, you could pull over. The only tweak that I would be open to, and I don't know if this is splitting hairs, as I understand the current law, in order to legally use the cell phone, you have to actually be pulled over, and the car has to be off, and you have to have the keys out of the car. I would be open to an exemption for your situation as long as you were pulled over and the car was in park or something. I mean, you know, recognizing that you guys do a lot of kind of pulling and sitting and waiting, that's not as an important fact to me that the car is pulled over and the keys are out of the ignition. So I'm open to something like that to provide a little bit more flexibility. Like I said, I don't know if that's splitting hairs and unnecessary, but as far as the ability to talk on the cell phone while physically driving, just from my own experience with it, I'm not going to be able to get there for you, but I do respect you for coming and advocating for your company.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your
time. Thank you very much, Darren. Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 294 and open up a work session. We'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 37. Jan, if you could refresh our memories, please.
Yes. Committee members, this measure was heard on the 29th of April. It specifies that OLCC can refuse to issue a license to an applicant if the applicant's been convicted of a federal law that's substantially related to the fitness and the ability of that applicant to carry out their activities. There were no amendments. It came over on a Senate vote of 28-0. There's no revenue impact, and there's no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 37 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 37 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll?
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Weidner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kinnaman.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, motion passes. So I close the work session on Senate Bill 37 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 38A.
Madam Chair, committee members, this measure also comes from OLCC. It reconciles statutes related to nonprofit or charitable organizations holding an auction or a raffle of alcoholic liquor. This declares an emergency effective on passage. Came over on a Senate vote of 29-0. No amendment, no revenue, no fiscal.
Okay, thank you. Representative.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 38A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 38A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll?
Representative Weidner.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Thacker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kinnaman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. I'll carry this one to the floor. We didn't get a carrier bill last one, did we?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I close the work session on Senate Bill 38A, and I reopen a work session on Senate Bill 37. We need a carrier on that bill. Representative Weidner.
Good bill.
Then I again close the work session on Senate Bill 37. Okay. Any more business before us? Okay, seeing none, we will see you guys Monday.